A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 23, 1987, in the series The Mystery of God's Grace, entitled Finding Our Destiny in God's Gracious Purpose. The scripture reading is Esther 4, verses 1 through 17. The text for the sermon is Esther 4, verse 14. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
It would be easier to be faithful unto death if one felt during the course of one's life that one's life was being woven into a fabric, a tapestry, which was of God's ordering, that one's life was finding its destiny in God's gracious purpose, that one's life was a part of a larger network, indeed, a network of cosmic dimension and eternal significance. To feel that we're not just living in the course of a history that is unraveling without any meaning, any direction, or any goal. To live with a sense that there is rather an overarching purpose, that there is an intentional will for salvation, a gracious purpose at work, and that our individual lives and our corporate life together could be caught up into the effecting of that purpose. To live that way would be to live with meaning, would be to have a sense of significance, would be to know who one was and what one was about and where one was going. God's sovereign grace is operative in the structures of history and in the circumstances of human experience, we believe. That is biblical faith. It is bedrock Old Testament faith. It has always been the confidence of Israel, and it is the confidence of the church that was born out of the womb of Israel. That bedrock conviction that history is not helter-skelter, willy-nilly, meandering on its way with no pre-planning, no pre-intention, and no directive will, but rather that history is His story, that history is a drama that is moving toward a goal that God has set, that God will certainly accomplish, and that He will accomplish through the likes of us. That our lives can have the significance and the meaning of being a part, of being an instrument in the effecting of the gracious purposes of God. To live that way would be to live happily. To live that way would be to live with a sense of fulfillment, with satisfaction. To live that way would to be to live according to the intention of God for us. To talk about the mystery of God's sovereign grace is not simply an exercise in speculative philosophical theology, although in the tradition of which we are a part, there certainly has been a lot of philosophical speculation about the mystery of God's will or His sovereign purpose. But what we are doing in this series is rather trying to bring that sometimes rather esoteric subject down to the midst of our human experience so that we can know personally that our lives are caught up in the purpose of God. And that as we live our lives day by day, we are not simply living either in a kind of automatic response, mechanical reaction, kind of a a life which is just going through the motions of that which God has already determined anyway, but neither is our life without direction, without goal, without purpose, just a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. To believe, to have a sense that one's life, one's destiny, is involved with the gracious purpose of God is probably one of the greatest gifts with which a person can live. And the Bible's full of stories of people who believe that. Not in a presumptuous way, not in a proud way. If everyone is overwhelmed by the grace of God and has a sense of being an instrument in the purpose of God, one is so humbled that one would not think of boasting. But to have that sense is to be full of grace and gratitude and to respond gladly, to put oneself at the disposal of God. And this Old Testament story, the story of Esther, we can see Israel's faith in the sovereign grace and saving purpose of God vividly portrayed through the counsel of Mordecai to Esther. Now you probably remember that old story from your Sunday school days. It's a fascinating tale. You ought to read it this afternoon. It reads like a historical novel. That's probably what it is. It very likely reflects a core of genuine historical experience which has been embroidered with all kinds of legend and additions through the years. And it's kind of an explanation of why the Jews keep the Feast of Purim. But in the midst of the story, there comes through this articulation of a faith in the sovereign, gracious purpose of God that is affected in history through those who put themselves at God's disposal. And so it's a wonderful story in which to get the picture of what I think is the most profound insight of Israel and of the Christian church in terms of our lives and their meaning in the broader historical landscape. The king of Persia was Xerxes, we're told, and he had fabulous wealth and pomp and circumstance, and for 6 months he showed off all of this to whoever would come from wherever. And so with his court full of dignitaries, he made this obscene display of wealth and glory until at the end of the 6 months, he was going to have a banquet. And of course, in those days, banquets didn't happen at noon. They happened for 7 days. And all the time, the wine flowing, so that at the end of 7 days, King Xerxes was in no condition to rule. But all at once he remembered that the finest gem in his crown was his queen Vashti, notable for her beauty. And so he thought he would beckon her and put her on display. But Vashti, in the first evidence of feminine revolt in history, said no. Good for her. But that created a crisis in court. And so the king called his counselors, because for the first time he had been rejected by his queen. She had refused to do his bidding, and he said, "What shall we do, boys?" And they said, "Well, we have to do something, because if word gets out that the queen didn't come at your beck and call, then all the wives in the kingdom are going to do the same thing, and we will have the feminine mystique long before Betty Friedan." And so they killed Vashti, of course, so that the word got out that such revolt would be dealt with appropriately. And then, in order to replace Vashti, they called the first Miss America contest in history. It was the Miss Persia contest, of course, and they went through all the land looking for the most beautiful woman in the whole land, and they gathered all of these beauties together, and for 12 months they prepared them for their audience with the king. 6 months with Estee Lauder, and Oil of Olay. 6 months in the School of Beauty run by Burt Parks. And finally, they were paraded before His Sovereign Majesty. And of course, Esther was chosen. She became the queen. She, the adopted daughter of Mordecai, a Jew, who said to her, "Don't let anybody know you're a Jew," because anti-Semitism is not something that was born with the 20th century. A Jew is always safer if people don't know it. And so Esther is now queen to King Xerxes, who has a prime minister who hates the Jews because Mordecai is a Jew, and Mordecai will not bow and scrape before Haman, the prime minister. And so in order to retaliate, Haman wants to destroy the Jews, and he, through a little craft, works a deal whereby the king passes an edict that on a certain day out in the future, the Jews will be destroyed throughout the kingdom. Mordecai learns of this. He sends word to Esther, entreating her to intervene with the king on behalf of her people. But Esther says, but do you know what it is to be a husband of this man? He said, no one can just barge into the king's presence. I haven't been called for 30 days, and if I barge into his presence, unless he extends his golden scepter to me, it's my life. A little cautious reserve on Esther's part was also appropriate. But Mordecai said to her, "Esther, if you keep silence at a time like this, don't think that you will escape with your skin. For you will be destroyed with your father's house as well as all the rest of the Jews." And he said, "If you keep silence, deliverance will come from another quarter, but you will be destroyed. And Esther, who knows but what you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Now I submit to you that in Mordecai's word to Esther, there is profound wisdom which reflects the confidence, the conviction of biblical faith at its deepest. Old Mordecai, who shared with Esther that counsel, had a deep conviction about the certainty of the predestinating intention of God to bring about salvation in the world. He had an absolute confidence in the sovereignty of God to effect His purposes. He had not a doubt but what God had promised God would do. But he also, far from a kind of a speculative, abstract, philosophical idea of God's predestinating intention, understood the reality of the human situation, understood the genuine human encounter with God, understood that God effects His purposes sovereignly and graciously, but always with contingency plans, and he knew that there comes into the life of people and individuals from time to time those special moments when God will do a marvelous thing for those that put themselves at His disposal. He said in the first place that if Esther would keep silence, deliverance for the Jew would come from another quarter. Now that was a wonderful confidence with which to live. When you figure that in the empire there had been an edict passed that bespoke the destruction of this people at a certain date out in the future, Mordecai, nevertheless, was not with white-knuckled intensity hanging on, pleading, groveling in the dust before Queen Esther. He was not biting his fingernails. He was not panic-stricken. He was not paralyzed by fear. He simply, rather deliberately, calmly, set before her this which he believed with every pore of his being, and that was that the people of God would be delivered. Because he believed that God had engaged himself with Abraham in a covenant relationship and had made promises to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob, and that through Israel all nations of the earth would be blessed. He believed that that covenant of grace that was instituted was a covenant that had in view the whole world, the whole cosmos, and all nations, and he believed that God would effect his purposes one way or another, through Esther or in spite of Esther, but it would be done. Now that is bedrock biblical faith. It's a great way to live. It is a way to live with confidence and calm serenity in the midst of a world of change and peril and threat. It is just that deep assurance, that God-level confidence that God is God, and God will be God, and God's purpose will be effected, a sovereign purpose, a gracious purpose, a saving purpose. It is the conviction that when God created the human creature over against himself, he entered into relationship, endowing that creature with freedom and responsibility, but committing himself to that creature and to that created world. That God determined to be the ally, that God determined to be for us, that God determined to be with us, and that God would be our Redeemer and our Savior, and that finally the kingdoms of this world would become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. That is that overarching providence of God that will finally accomplish the purpose of God and fulfill the promise of God. It's a wonderful way to live. But that kind of trust, which is not something available to human rationality, not something that we can figure out in terms of scraping together the data of history. It's not something we can even look back upon in retrospect and put all the connections together and say, aha, that's exactly what God was doing. Too often in the church, we have known too much, we have been sure of too much, we have been dogmatic about too much. The human situation is full of ambiguity. It is characterized by suffering. It is shot through with tragedy. There is all that that happens which we can only say is senseless and meaningless, which we cannot understand, which leaves us in the darkness. But it is even in the darkness that the child of God says, yet there is light. Even in the darkness, when there is no plan or purpose that is evident, when there is no clue on the horizon to what God is up to, then still the child of God, steeped in biblical faith, says, yet I trust in the gracious, sovereign promise and purpose of God. Keep quiet if you will, Esther, but deliverance for the Jew will arise from another quarter. And yet, in that counsel, there is also this insight of Mordecai, which we have so often missed in the church and in our theological tradition. Mordecai also said to Esther, not only deliverance will arise, he also said to Esther, but if you keep silence, you may perish with all your household. And what he was saying in that was that I am no Pollyanna. I am no superficial optimist whistling in the dark, just believing that somehow or other it'll all go away. I'm not just going to sit down and wait for it to happen, knowing that inevitably whatever will be, will be. Mordecai was no fatalist. He believed absolutely in the predetermined intention of God to be a redeemer. But he also believed that in the meantime, there was all kinds of elbow room for the creature. There was all kinds of maneuverability. He believed in a God who always has contingency plans. And what he was saying to Esther is simply this. If you fail to respond to this moment, if you fail to stand up and be counted at this moment, deliverance will come for the Jew from another quarter, because it is too much for any human being to bear to think that on her shoulders all of the destiny of the world rests. It rests not on any human shoulders, but on God. But he also said to her, there is the possibility that deliverance might be effected through you. Deliverance will come, but you may perish if you keep silence. We may suffer. All the Jews of Susa may be slaughtered. All of the Hebrews of the Persian Empire may be annihilated. The Holocaust may happen in Persia. Mordecai knew that in the course of history, there is all kinds of devastation, all kinds of human sin and the manifestation of evil. Mordecai knew that it's no Pollyanna view. Rather, he as a Jew was representative of that people who probably has suffered in history more than any other. The film Fiddler on the Roof closes with the families of Anatevka silhouetted on the screen with their wagons piled with all their earthly goods, leaving the village that they loved, fleeing another pogrom. This people, who suffered more than any other people, are the very people who have given to the world this deep conviction that God is God and that God affects his purposes in the arena of history, a sovereign, gracious purpose. But it's not mechanical. It's not automatic. It's not all cut and dried. We've stumbled so often over that idea that everything that happens is the will of God. That's just pure nonsense. Everything that happens is not the will of God. We could almost rather say everything that happens is contrary to the will of God, being who we are, obstinate, stubborn, anxious, and afraid. But, and this is the mystery, whatever happens, it doesn't derail that ultimate purpose of God. All the Jews of Susa may be annihilated, all the Hebrews of Persia may suffer death, but the covenant of God with Abraham could finally not be destroyed by the edict of any earthly sovereign. That's what old Mordecai was saying. In a world like ours, afraid of nuclear holocaust, we could say in a contemporary application, yes, we may blow ourselves out of the sky. Because God endowed us with a frightful gift of freedom and responsibility, and we have a potential within our hands, which is unbelievable, incredible. And yes, we have the freedom to do it. But blow it out of the sky if we will. It will not be the end of what God has intended for planet Earth or the human family. Finally, we rest in the gracious, sovereign purpose of God. But those gracious purposes of God are affected through human agency. And so that great challenge to Esther from old Mordecai. Hey, Esther, if you keep silent, deliverance will come from another quarter. You may perish. But say, Esther, what if you've come to the kingdom for just such a time as this? And that word time in the Greek translation of the Hebrew story is not chronos, which is the Greek word for ordinary time. Chronos, the Greek word, is the word that gives us chronology. And chronology is simply that rather monotonous recording of the succession of moments and hours and days and weeks and months and years. Chronology, just the ongoing moment succeeding moment in the ongoing rush of history. But the Greeks were more fortunate than we. They had another word for time. They had a word for time, kairos. And kairos meant the opportune moment, the critical moment, the moment of chronos filled with eternity. And when Mordecai spoke to Esther, he said, Esther, this is no ordinary moment. This is not just another moment in the succession of moments. This is not just another day in the story of days. This is the moment in which, placing yourself at God's disposal, you become the instrument of His salvation, the effector of His purpose. Wow. And again, It's possible to miss the moment. Jesus, who was born in the fullness of time, that Kairos moment, overlooked Jerusalem just before he died, and he wept and he said, "Jerusalem, if only you knew the things that make for peace, but now they are hid from your eyes. For you missed God's moment." It is possible in the course of human history and our human lives to miss the moment and to suffer the consequences in spite of the fact that the engine of God's sovereign grace moves on. Esther, consider carefully whether or not this may be your moment. And of course, the story ends with Esther responding faithfully and obediently and used wonderfully for the rescue of her people. The rescue of her people by the sovereign grace of God, who intends to redeem and uses human agency for the effecting of that purpose. Nothing philosophically ironclad about that. Not a stitch of fatalism in that. A God who is sovereign, a creature who is responsible and who is free, a creature who puts herself at the disposal of God for the effecting of his purpose and the salvation of this people through human agency because of the intention of God to redeem and to save. There's a mystery about the sovereign grace of God, but it's a wonderful thing when one has a sense that one's life is finding its destiny as an instrument of his gracious purpose. And I suppose that there is no one here that would contest that. But there also may be no one here who would dare say, "Here am I, send me." Our response would be like Moses. "Who, me? I can't even talk." Or like Isaiah, who saw the vision and said, "Lord, I'm a man of unclean lips." Or throughout the history, Peter said, "Depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." Problem is, we don't take ourselves seriously enough. Maybe we in the church have done such a good job of brainwashing us as to our unworthiness and the impossibility of anything good being effected through us, that maybe we finally believe it, so that when the moment dawns, we don't rise to the occasion and say, "Here am I, send me." I think it was D.L. Moody who said, "The world has yet to see what God could do through one life totally dedicated to his purpose." It is God's saving, sovereign grace. It is God's predestinating determination and intention. It is all of God's power and all of God's mercy. But only through the likes of us, who, if we would only take ourselves as seriously as God would take us, would turn the world upside down. And wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be exciting? We'd forget the headaches and the arthritis. There'd be no time for ulcers. We'd stop the bickering and the party sectarian spirit and grumbling about Reagan in the White House. And we'd get on with affecting and bringing into reality that wonderful, wonderful picture of what God's sovereign grace is effecting in the course of this old world. Ah, I wonder if there's anyone here this morning who might be at that Kairos moment in which God could do some splendid thing to the glory of His name and the building of His kingdom. Who knows? But what you came to church for, just such a word as that.